Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Before I get to my very special guest tonight, I want to tell you about Eric Hunt's new video. It's a full-length film, actually, and encourage you to go to the website where it can be viewed for free and send him a donation if it is at all possible for you to do so. The website is http://holocaustdenier.com. That's Holocaust Denier, one word, http://holocaustdenier.com. The title of Eric's over two-hour-long film is The Last Days of the Big Lie. It's a critical look at Steven Spielberg's award-winning Holocaust documentary, The Last Days. It's hard-hitting. Take it from me. After you've watched it, click on Donate on the menu bar at the top of the page, and then use the Donate button at the far right of your screen. The other one doesn't seem to be working. Or there's also a mailing address if you want to send cash, money order, or a check. The reason that Eric needs this money right now is to purchase additional hard drive space to store further video audio material that is available to him. His work also requires travel, and he can't do it without help from us. If you can only give $5 or $10, do that, because it will add up if enough people contribute. And by the way, Eric Hunt will be my guest next week on the Heretics Hour. Now, I'm very excited to welcome someone I've wanted to have as a guest for months now, and he has finally relented, and he is here now, someone who needs no introduction, I'm sure, the one and only Michael Collins Piper. Hello, Michael.
Hey, Carolyn, that's quite an introduction. You say I need no introduction. Well, I got a hell of an introduction there. I appreciate that.
Well,
incidentally, Eric Hunt, I had wanted to have him on my program on that other network where I had been broadcasting for so long. There's a really gutsy guy. I don't really know much about his background, but I think he represents a very good thing in our world today, because here's a young guy. I mean, I'm 50 years old, so I've been around this for a long, long time. But here's a young guy who has, I guess, stumbled onto the truth about some pretty big issues in our world today, and he's going to be carrying on the fight a long time after I'm in a nursing home, so I'm glad to see that.
Michael, you're never going to be in a nursing home.
Well, I use that term generally, yeah.
No, don't even say it or think about it.
I guess you're right.
I'm a big person on visualizing things. Okay, well, this is a fantastic film. He calls it a video, but it's really a film. He calls it his first draft. But you must take some time out and go and watch it. And I've been conversing with him, and I want him to be able to get the rest of all of this material on his on hard drive, so that he doesn't have to depend on it being available out there in case it is no longer. I don't want to say too much about it, but he really, even if people can give just a little bit, I mean, if enough people do, it adds up, and he doesn't need that much, but he needs, you know, a substantial amount. So, anyway, back to you now. If you want to talk a little bit about your move from that other network to what you're doing now on your independent podcast, or...
Well, that's exactly what I am doing, and I have to say, I appreciated the time that I had on the other network for all those years. You know, every day of my life, that's my problem, I suppose. I live and breathe politics, from waking up in the morning to the time I lay my head down at night. I'm constantly reading and listening and watching and doing that broadcast every night. I would have the opportunity in the daytime to sit there and think, well, what am I going to talk about this evening, and try to put my thoughts into a verbal framework within a one-hour period of time. But with this new podcast, which is at michaelcollinspiper.podbean.com, I basically have really all the time in the world I want, but I kind of pretty much keep it to an hour, to really talk very freely and without a feeling of potentially offending the boss or offending certain group of listeners or anything. I can just say what I believe and believe what I say. I've always done that. But, you know, this day and age we live in, Carolyn, and I don't need to tell you that, we have reached this point where so many people are looking over their shoulders or are whispering when, in fact, they should actually be standing up and shouting out, you know, because I think that what's happening in our world today, things are escalating to the point, you know, we're you know, they always say, well, we're in the nuclear age, you know, where the press of a button could destroy the world. Well, that's absolutely true. And we're also in an age where, and we're hearing so much about it in the wake of the Arizona shooting, that the political rhetoric is cranking up. The volume is increasing, and there's a lot of anger. And the people who are so responsible for this state of affairs in the world today, they are the people who have their hands on the nuclear button. And I am specifically referring, as you might guess, to the state of Israel, because, you know, I have said time and time again, you know, I've been around this thing for a long, long time, that I really, truly believe the preeminent problem in our American political situation today, and as a consequence, obviously, in our world situation today, is this inordinate and virtually uncontrolled Jewish political, economic, media, and military/nuclear power. Not just the state of Israel, but right here on American shores, where we have essentially been dispossessed by a very wealthy elite who are primarily Jewish. A lot of people don't like to hear that said, but it's a fact. Anyone who denies it is either a liar or a fool. We have this situation where there's immense Jewish political power, and anyone who dares to stand up and challenge them, they will do whatever they can to cut their heads off. Right now, it's being done figuratively, but I'm here to tell you, Carolyn, and again, this is no surprise to you or to any of your listeners, if the Jews and the people who are in their loop, so to speak, had it their way, they would not permit programs like yours or mine or so many other independent voices on the Internet and elsewhere. They would not permit us to speak out. And you know what? They would put us in concentration camps, and they would put us in gas chambers. It's that simple. We know that there are, what, 14 countries in the world, and there are other places where it's pending. Nations around the world, and they're mostly so-called democratic countries in the so-called democratic West, where if you simply raise questions about the Holocaust, you will go to jail. Mm-hmm. And if the Jews had their way, that is exactly what would happen in this country. And over the years, I've watched it happening. There have been efforts to gradually push through legislation that sets up a framework wherein this kind of legislation that I was talking about could actually be ushered right in the name of democracy. That's the irony about it.
Yes.
So we have to be constantly alert on it.
Yeah, protecting democracy. That's
exactly.
That's why they have it twisted around.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, a lot of people were worried, and rightly so, about these hate crimes laws that were recently enacted. But, you know, I'll tell you what, a lot of people have confused the hate crimes legislation with Holocaust denial legislation. That's one point that should be made clear. The actual hate crimes legislation has been in force, and it should have never been enacted, but it's been in force since about 1968, the original hate crimes legislation. As an example, if you go out and you hit somebody over the head with a baseball bat under normal legislation, you know, you will be arrested for assault and battery. But with the enactment of the hate crimes legislation, if you went out and hit a black person over the head with a baseball bat, and in the course of so doing, you called him a nasty name, a racial name, then they could enforce a federal hate crimes charge against you because they say you were motivated by hate. Well, what was done more recently was they expanded the hate crimes legislation now to include, as they say, gays, lesbians, transgenders.
Yeah, transgenders.
And then they also, for good measure, people who have disabilities. Now they're talking about expanding the hate legislation further to make it a federal crime if you commit an act of violence or perceived threat against someone who is homeless. As I keep saying, well, then they're going to have to start broadening it to people who wear hats and people who don't wear hats and people who have blonde hair and people who
are expecting and, more homeless, too.
Yeah.
They know there's going to be more homeless people. So
yeah,
can,
yeah.
You know,
so it's turning. Yes, exactly. The way
homeless people will probably be turning on the people with homes, and so that way they can get a lot of people with homes.
I mean, you know this political correctness in our society today has gone to madness. But we have not yet reached a point in America at the federal level or anywhere for that matter where you can be charged with what we generally know of as Holocaust denial. But I can tell you that there are communities across America where they have enforced ordinances and statutes regarding what they call ethnic intimidation. For example, if you get into an argument with your local Jewish moneylender, and you call him a nasty name and shake your fist at him, if you call him a term that refers to his ethnic or religious heritage, you might be charged with ethnic intimidation. So the groundwork is already there for this kind of thought control legislation. And then when you crank in this other things like the Patriot Act and all of this kind of hidden legislation, we do have very real concerns in this country. And you know, I guess my feeling has been I'm just going to keep speaking out till they cut my head off or throw me in a concentration camp, but I'm going to make it very difficult for them to do that. And if they can take away our First Amendment freedom in this country, then really everything is lost. Because even if they take the guns away with us, get guns away from us, we can always throw stones like the Palestinians do.
Oh, yeah, but don't say that.
Yeah.
Don't say that. Oh God, that if they take the second, then it won't.
Oh yeah, no, I mean it's
we really.
But
what you're saying here is that things are in a very bad way, and yet people are not seeming to be aware of it. They're except for this, you know, small group, they're believing that all this has a good purpose and it's necessary to protect people and. How do we wake people up? You know, when you started speaking, Michael, what came to my mind was Adolf Hitler's comments that have been, of course, used against him in that speech that when he said, if the Jews start a war that turns into a world war, they are going to suffer. You know, they're the ones who are going to lose out and the word was used that was something like close to exterminated, but it meant they were going to be, you know, out of control. They were going to lose. They were going to, you know, they were going to be.
They're going to lose. Yeah, exactly.
They were going to lose, and they were not going to be in control anymore because we weren't going to tolerate. That wouldn't be tolerated. Well, that didn't happen that way, and we're in that same situation. And if they're going to start world wars, a world war, if they're going to do all this, what's going to happen?
This is the whole thing. I mean, let's just be direct and honest about it here. We don't have to.
That's exactly right.
You know, the fact is that all of the wars we're involved in the Middle East right now are a direct consequence of Jewish political power and intrigue. World War II, obviously, no question about that. And, of course, you know, even World War One. You know, World War One. You know,
oh,
was
yes.
from a historical standpoint, World War One is virtually forgotten in the minds of most people. But the fact is, if you even look at World War One, there is absolutely no question that Jewish intrigues behind the scenes led to World War One and American involvement in World War One. There was a Jewish writer from Russia named Yuri Slechkine who wrote a book called The Jewish Century.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was more talking directly about Russia, I have always thought that phrase, the Jewish century, that terminology could be used to describe the 20th century, because in the 20th century, I think we saw we saw Jewish power rise, spiral upward like it had never spiraled before. But I think it's going to come to an end. I don't think the 21st century will be the Jewish century. I think that in the 21st century, you know, it's going to collapse just on by its own weight. But in the meantime, mm-hmm. I am afraid that things are going to get a lot worse before they get a lot better. And it's actually a very scary time in which to live.
Well, what you say is reasonable. That's still going to get worse before
yeah.
it gets better, and that it probably will have to collapse eventually. But what that collapse will bring, I don't know. But I'm going to present you now all these things you've said have brought up something in my mind, and I'm going to present you with a rather difficult question here. Speaking of how the people don't understand what's really going on. And then I look at what popped right into my mind was this it's beginning to be questioned now, the difference between the anti-Zionists and the anti-Semitics or the anti-Jews, or the difference between Zionism and Judaism and who is the culprit and why it's Zionism and not Judaism, and all of these people in our, supposedly that so many of in this, again, quote, movement, quote,
yeah.
very loose, feel that are saying good things and are doing good work, and yet they are mostly going after Zionism and making this big distinction and trying to separate it from Jews, and also trying to make out that if you say anything about it, you're creating dissension, and we need to keep everybody under this roof no matter what they're doing. And yet, what is this distinction between Zionism and Judaism doing?
Well, you know what? I don't make the distinction, but let me start off. That's a great question because it really cuts right to the core of what's happening in the world today. This is one of my favorite quotations. It's from a Jewish American author named Gerald Krefetz, Krefetz. In his book, Jews and Money, The Myths and the Reality, he said this. So succinctly, he said, perhaps it is possible to separate Jewish interests from Israeli interests, but the trick is yet to be turned. What touches Israel touches global Jewry and vice versa. Purists and theoreticians may argue about the separation of church and state, Jews and Israelis, Judaism and Zionism, but in the real world, the connection is hard, fast, and seemingly indivisible. I quote that word for word because I couldn't put it any better myself, and for the benefit of those who like to be able to cite Jewish sources, which are always valuable, that's a Jewish source. And you know what it all comes down to, Carolyn? We've all heard this refrain time and again, Judaism is not Zionism, and Zionism is not Judaism. Well, you know, in the theoretical world, that's true. And it's true that not all Jews are Zionists. Mm. There are many Jews who are, number one, critics of Israel and very forthright and effective critics of Israel. But they're not necessarily critics of Zionism. They do support the state of Israel. Then there
and
is
then,
a...
And then beyond Israel as Zionism...
Yes, exactly. See, that's the whole thing.
There's more to it, yeah.
Much more to it. Zionism is Judaism. Zionism is a direct political arm of Judaism, and what people seem to forget. And it's very, very simple. You know, I've said it 100 times, that for 1,000 years before the State of Israel, which came about in 1948, very, very different groups of people in Europe and elsewhere, all of whom had pivotal disagreements among themselves, they all came together on one issue in that all of those different groups that were divided among themselves all came together and had problems with the Jewish communities in their countries, in their cities, in their principalities. There has been this historical wall between the Jews and the non-Jews, and that was long before there was a state of Israel. Now, people will say, well, the Jews were persecuted. In fact, you know, I have found more and more in my own research, and I'm talking about coming from Jewish sources, I've been finding that so many, even of the past stories of persecution that we've heard about, you know, over the centuries, they're, mm-hmm. it's not quite been presented. In fact,
I don't believe it. I don't believe it much. I think there's always been a cause.
Yeah, I mean, Carolyn, when they were held in captivity in Babylon, as the legend goes, they achieved supreme power in Babylon.
That's right.
And, you know, and this is the first...
Of course, something that I wonder nowadays, I used to believe all those legends, but now I say, these are legends, and they were written by the Jews. So, you know, did they really have all this power?
You know, okay, here's the perfect...
okay.
Here's the perfect example that's been in the news of recent date. Sarah Palin, I would say quite stupidly, used the term blood libel in her defense against all these crazy allegations. And you know, I don't like Sarah Palin. I emphasize that.
Doesn't she have any advisors? She comes out with this stuff like very amateurish.
Yes, exactly. That's what it strikes me as. But you know, the funny thing about the famous blood libel, now the legend of the blood libel, as we always hear about it in the media, is that the evil Christians criticized the poor Jews of practicing evil religious rites on innocent Christian children, and of course the Jews say, well, this isn't true. Well, you know, number one, the fact is there is a historical foundation for these charges by the Christians against the Jews. But here's where it gets tricky and very, very interesting. In a book which I had in my hands just a couple days ago, now of course I've put it back on the shelf, but it's a book about anti-Semitism, and it's edited by an Israeli academic. But what's interesting is, in the pages of this book, you find out that, in fact, the original quote-unquote blood libel about children being used for religious sacrifices was actually a charge made against the Jews against the early Christians. You know, and even the stories we hear about, oh, the poor Jews were accused of poisoning the wells.
Mm-hmm.
Those charges were originally made by the Jews against the early Christians. I mean, even in ancient Rome, I have a whole book published by an Israeli publishing company in English about ancient Roman legislation dealing with the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, it's very, very clear that it was the Jews who were waging pogroms against the Christians, and it got so bad that the Roman authorities had to enact legislation which basically said, Jews, stop tormenting the Christians. So,
really? See, that all should come out more. And, you know, of course, in the very beginning, the earliest Christians were persecuted by the Jews.
Yeah, and everything that we're told is just not true. I'll tell you another favorite story that I love to pound home. And I discovered this quite by accident a few years ago. I don't even remember how I came across it originally. But, you know, I remember going back to the time when I was about 15 or 16 years old, reading a book called Bigotry in America. And it was by, I think that it was by a Jewish author. It strikes me his name, it may have been Gustavus Myers, M-Y-E-R-S. But in any case, it talked about the Know-Nothing Movement, and it said how the Know-Nothing Movement persecuted Jews and immigrants. Well, you know, it turns out that one of the earliest leaders of the Know-Nothing Movement, who was such a leader of the movement that he was actually the publisher of the Know-Nothing National Newspaper, and he was one of the first Know-Nothing members of Congress elected, was a Jew from my home state of Pennsylvania named Louis Charles Levin. So here was a Jew who was a leader of the Know-Nothing movement who was saying that Irish Catholics didn't belong in America because, and I happen to be of Irish Catholic descent on one side of the family, so I take personal umbrage there. But here was this Jew coming out and saying, well, we've got to stop the Irish Catholics from coming into the United States. But do you hear about that in history? No. You hear that the Know-Nothing Movement was persecuting Jews
yes.
and Catholics. Well,
exactly. Mike, we have to take a break now. So we'll continue with this. And when we come back, I have a question for you from Steve from Chicago. See us. Stick with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Years ago, in 1961, Dwight D. Eisenhower warned of the negative effects of a military-industrial complex, an idea that's rarely questioned or even discussed in the media today. Let's take a listen to what he said.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
So was it a prophecy, and will things ever change in regards to the defense industry and what some dub perpetual warfare? Well, for more, author of this book right here, The Family of Secrets, the Bush Dynasty, Russ Baker, is talking to us from New York City. Russ, good to see you. So, you know, the perspective that Eisenhower seemed to warn against is this idea of quote-unquote military metaphysics, which basically paints the picture that international reality is basically military. Do you think that this kind of thinking shapes foreign policy in the U.S. today?
I don't know if the thinking shapes it, but it reflects the reality. And in fact, 50 years later, things are only much, much worse than the way that Eisenhower characterized it. And it's so interesting that he himself was a heroic military figure from World War II. What we see today is what I would call a military, industrial, intelligence, oil, media complex. It's much broader, it's much more pervasive, and now we also have this whole new area called Homeland Security, an ill-defined but vast area that keeps takes tremendous amounts of money from the American taxpayer and also keeps us in a state of sort of low-grade panic all the time. So I think things are much, much worse. And by the way, today also is Martin Luther King Day, where we're honoring an individual who played a very important role in this country in fostering a very different set of values. He, of course, was assassinated by what was described as a lone nut. This is the 50th anniversary of the inauguration of John F. Kennedy, assassinated by what was described as a lone nut. They also tried to tie that to blame the Soviet Union and Cuba for that. And we have this past week a number of very strange deaths of figures associated with the federal government, a congresswoman, a Democratic congresswoman, a former Pentagon official found in a trash dumpster in Delaware, a woman whose husband is top person in the Obama administration was found in her burned out car in her garage. These are very, very troubling times. And we don't have the kind of transparency we need. We don't have any grip on this complex. We have very little understanding of how it works. And all the records most of them remain classified under lock and key, so we can't figure out what went on and what's going on today.
So you're saying a lot of different entities involved, a lot of similar interests. And it's interesting that you mentioned Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., because an Obama administration official recently came out and sort of used Dr. King's legacy to say that he would actually...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and with me is Michael Collins Piper. We're having a lively conversation, and as I promised, I'm going to ask him a question from his loyal listener who can't call in anymore. Steve from Chicago, and Steve calls me every so often. He has lots of information he likes to impart, and he has currently been reading this book. It's excerpts from the Talmud, and it's a very large book, he says. He's been reading it for weeks and weeks, and it's in German, and it's written by a German from the 17th century who lived in Hamburg, I think, and they had a lot of trouble with the Jews at that time, and he wrote all this stuff, and he studied the Talmud and saw what the people were doing, and here's what Steve wants you to know. Jews were advised by the rabbis to evade customs duties. And the custom duties means, you know, when you have to declare your goods or your shipments when you're crossing a border, and when you declare what goods you have, because sometimes the people who are the inspectors are not able, they can't count and look, you know, and check everything from everybody who's coming along. And so they have to take your word for part of it. So you swear an oath about, like, how many fox skins you have or how many bushels of corn or what all you're carrying. And this oath is taken very seriously. And if you are found later to have not told the truth, you can be in big legal trouble. But now he says that what the book says is that the rabbis were telling the Jews to evade these custom duties unless it was a capital offense. And if it's a capital offense, of course, they shouldn't do it, because if they got caught, they might, would be put to death. And being put to death is the greatest worst. Putting a Jew to death, you know, for a Jew to be killed or die is the worst thing in the whole world, because they're, of course, precious in the sight of God. And so they should never let their life be taken. But for anything less, yeah, they should take the chance and try to pay less money. And Steve says this is in connection with Yom Kippur, you know, where they're able to undo all the oaths that they made during the year on Yom Kippur, one of their holy days. And that makes them, you know, completely innocent again if they don't keep their oaths. And Steve made the connection that Hitler's father was a customs official, as we know, and they lived on the border of Austria and Germany. And Steve wonders if Hitler's father came home at night and complained about the Jews cheating the Reich, because he was a very conscientious man and very conscientious about his job and proud of the status that he had achieved in life, because he started out in a peasant home. And so he says, well, you know, Steve is imagining, did Hitler, Adolf hear his father complaining about the Jews, you know, at the dinner table at night after a hard day's work? And, you know, the funny thing is, I don't know, there's no answer to that, really. But the funny thing is that my father did a few times complain about the difficulties that he had to endure in business with Jews that he had to do business with. He didn't have any choice. And what they did to him. And so I remember that. He didn't do it very often, but he did it enough a few times, and I remembered it very much. And it kind of worried me, because even then I knew that somehow you weren't supposed to not like Jews, and you weren't supposed to talk bad about Jews. You know, that's just in the consciousness, I think, from anybody from 1945 onward. So that's my lead in there, and you can say what you want about that, but also let's talk about your book that you're writing about Hitler, and why you want to write it, and how it's going.
Well, it all does tie together. And first of all, I want to say hello to Steve and let him know when he hears this podcast that I have his telephone number on a piece of paper in my briefcase, and I keep carrying it back and forth between my home and the office. And I am going to get around to calling him sooner or later. But at any rate, in regard to that question that he asked, that's very interesting. I will say this much. I have been doing a lot of reading on Hitler, obviously, in the course of doing this research for a book on Hitler that I am going to be actually writing very soon. Actually, it's probably mostly written now in the form of dictation. It's now a matter of actually putting it into the computer. But in any case, I have never actually, now that I think about it, come across any information that Hitler got any negative attitudes toward Jews from his inner circle, that is, his family circles. Mm-hmm. Anything that Hitler's own development, as I understand it, based on what has been written by Hitler himself in Mein Kampf and written by other historians, that Hitler's realization of the Jewish role in society, not just in Germany but throughout civilization, came about just as a consequence of his own observations. And, you know, I find that very, very interesting, because in the course of working on another book, I've been reflecting upon my own personal involvement with the issue and how it came about. And, you know, it's funny. I had an uncle who I would see every couple years who was very interested in what we might call the Jewish question. And, you know, despite the fact that I would hear him saying negative things about the Jews, it did not influence me one way or the other. All of the opinions that I arrived at came from my own reading and research, not from anybody whispering in my ear. It was a long-term development. It was an evolving and developing thing. So while, you may find one or two people who may have been influenced in their thinking by what other people have said, in my own personal experience, when I have talked to so many people over the years about this topic or related topics and asked them how their views evolved, that word evolved is in fact correct, because this is how most people have come to the realization that, well, Jews are different, that Jews do have immense political power, that Jews have a different world outlook. It's something that cannot be denied, and the Jews themselves will be the first to say that. Now, about Hitler and about the Jews and about our world today, I would have never thought that I would be writing a book about Adolf Hitler. First of all, because, number one, so many thousands and thousands of books have been written on the topic.
Really?
Obviously.
Would you say thousands and thousands? That's really amazing.
It is. And they're all so repetitive. And now, of course, in recent years, thank God, we've had a lot of books on the subject of the Holocaust in terms of Holocaust revisionism, reporting the facts, not the myths about the Holocaust. But the book that I'm writing about Adolf Hitler, I'm very pleased to say. Now, I know that my critics, that is the Jews, will say, oh, well, Piper's just going to be writing another book that recapitulates what the Holocaust deniers have said and so forth. No, in fact, I have about 200 books that I have used. Actually, I should say probably closer to about 100 books and then maybe 100 newspaper articles and magazine articles and so forth that I've used for the foundation of this book that I'm writing on. And I think it's safe to say that about 98% of them are either books written by Jews representing the traditional Jewish viewpoint toward Hitler, or written by mainstream historians. And what I have found to be so extraordinary in the course of my research is that even within these books by mainstream historians, you find so many details about Adolf Hitler as a man, as a politician, as a statesman, and I emphasize the word statesman, that even in these mainstream books, this material is there for those who choose to see it, and those who choose to see it will recognize that what we have been told or what we believe generally about Adolf Hitler as a consequence of what we hear in the mass media and in academia is absolutely the opposite of the truth.
Yes.
And as I say, as I emphasize, the material that I've put together, I haven't cherry-picked. I mean, it's obvious that these writers are anti-Hitler, but even in the course of their writings, whether talking about Hitler's interpersonal relations, whether talking about Hitler's involvement in diplomacy, whether it's Hitler's military strategy, even his views on racial matters, what we think we know is just not the truth. And
yeah, well, I found the same thing, that in books and in writings where they are anti-Hitler all the way, you still find things that are good, and they're not able to cover it all up because it's
exactly
part
and
of the story.
what really inspired the book, I talked about how I never expected to write a book. What really inspired the book in many respects was the rise of the internet and the rise of the likes of people such as Alex Jones. And I always say when I mention Alex Jones that I don't like to personalize it, but you can't help but personalize it, because people such as Alex Jones have contributed so much to the misinformation and misinformation about Adolf Hitler and about the Third Reich, about what Hitler believed, about what Hitler wanted to accomplish. And, you know, it has become such a poison in popular discourse, or more directly, it's become such a poison in discourse among people in this movement, whatever we want to call this movement, it's become so widespread that I felt there was a need to write a corrective volume that says, hey, wait a minute, here's what you've heard about Hitler, here's what the patriots are saying about Hitler. All they're doing is repeating things from the mass media. But in fact, if you look at the facts, if you look at the real history, if you look at history as it's even been recorded by Hitler's most vituperous critics, you will find that the truth is anything but what we believe. And so I said to myself, my God, this is a book that needs to be written. And, you know, see, this is all going through my mind. And then one day I walked in to the Barnes Review office here in Washington, and the publisher, Willis Cardo, calls me aside. Of course, I've worked very closely with Willis for many years, and he and I see eye to eye on probably about 90% of things, and on those 10% of things that we disagree about, well, we'll always continue to disagree with. But Willis said to me with a very serious look on his face, he says, what are you working on right now? Are you working on any books? And I said, well, yeah, which ones? And he said, well, he says, I have an idea for a book for you. And I said, what's that? And he said, you need to write a book about Adolf Hitler. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I am going to. Well, as a consequence of that,
It sounds like it's a book that's destined to be and needs to be and should be because it came about so easily like that.
Yeah, and that's the funny thing about it, Carolyn. You know, like I said, I never expected to write a book about Hitler. And of course, when I wrote my book about the Kennedy assassination, I never thought that there was anything more I could add to the debate on that. But there has been such there has been such misuse of Adolf Hitler's name to the point that you cannot. I mean, even in this so-called patriot movement, I mean, if something bad happens, it's somehow linked to Adolf Hitler.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why it's come to the time where you need to name some names sometimes. I agree with you. I understand people say, oh, don't personalize it, as you put it. Don't mention this and that person because then it just creates a lot of animosity and so on. And yet there is a need to do that to an extent because if you're going to clear it up, you have to point out where these problems are.
You know, that's the thing. I mentioned this the other night on my own podcast, and I think it's very relevant. I know this young man who's a big fan of Alex Jones, and I constantly point out to him, you know, Alex Jones has put out the idea that Hitler was trying to conquer the world, that he really was part of the New World Order, that he represented the worst of this thing we call the New World Order. And I said, well, you know, you've gotten all that from Alex Jones. And I said, what does Alex Jones know about it? And he said, now, of course, I'm not quoting Alex directly. I'm quoting someone who described Alex's description of his own awareness of Hitler. Mm-hmm. And what Alex Jones said at the time was that he had grown up being interested in World War II. And consequently, he read all the books about Hitler. Mm-hmm. Well, then Alex said, according to this gentleman, Alex realized that there was a lot of other literature out there about Hitler that told a completely different story. So therefore, Alex reputedly said, I started reading all the other literature, and I realized then, well, of course, that Hitler was really part of the New World Order, that he was part of a grand conspiracy. You know, so basically what we have is Alex Jones latched on to a very small sliver of nonsensical, repetitive, I hate to use the term, but I mean, let's use it. It's nonsensical, it's repetitive, it's idiotic, baseless material conjured up by people who have absolutely no connection to reality. I mean, I'm sorry. I hate to be so judgmental, but, you know, somebody sent me a book the other day, a big fat book about 2.5 inches thick called Hitler with a British Agent.
Right.
Now, it's very impressive looking, you know, and it basically says that, well, really, Adolf Hitler was, in fact, a British agent. He was a traitor to the German people, that he started World War II for the purpose of destroying Germany on behalf of the British Empire. Now, that's a great conspiracy theory, but
and people love it.
And people love it.
It's like a spy story. You know,
Total nonsense.
So I'll tell you what makes it better.
I'll tell you what. If you actually read the book, there's some really bizarre stuff in the book that has nothing to do with the thesis itself, but it raises questions in my mind. If I were a psychiatrist, I would love to get the author of that book down on the couch and say, where'd you come up with this stuff? I mean, I don't have the book in front of me, and even if I did, I wouldn't quote some of the stuff from the book because it basically amounts to the kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, that stuff.
I'm trying to be very genteel here. Let's just put it this way. It's kind of like softcore porn.
Sure, sure. Oh my God, I've talked to people in my own community who come up with that porn stuff and sex stuff, and it just what do you say to these people? You can't. There's not much you can say. You know, this brings to mind a friend of mine met a man at a dinner party who had written a book about Adolf Hitler. This man was a psychiatrist, a medical doctor psychiatrist, and he wrote a book called The Medical Casebook of Adolf Hitler. And he gave a copy to my friend, and my friend read it, and he said, boy, this is really something, and he insisted on sending it to me. I said, I don't think I want to read it, but he did send it to me, and I started to read it. It made me so sick, I thought, I can never read this book, because it started out like at the ending. What a basket case Hitler was at the end, you know, because of all these amphetamines and so on that he was on, and all this different kind of drugs that his doctor was putting him on, and all this stuff to keep him going, because he had quit functioning properly years back, and you know, and it was so awful. But then I thought, well, I got at least skim through it, and I found some interesting stuff in it. But it turns out though that this man, he had some of his footnotes absolutely wrong. I mean, not just wrong. What he said, he found stuff that didn't even exist, because my friend looked it up and found it out, and he's still kind of communicating with him about it.
I tell you, Carol, you know what I find so revealing about this whole matter is that, you know, it's kind of interesting. In popular perception, in the media, we constantly hear, for example, that Hitler surrounded himself with gangsters, and that the whole National Socialist movement was anti-intellectual and this and that and such and such. And, you know, but actually, in fact, the Holocaust Museum held a seminar here some years ago in Washington, and the point of the seminar was that many, if not most, of the leading academics, intellectuals, artists, and cultural leaders, not only of Germany, but throughout Europe, were absolutely supportive of National Socialism and believed that it presented a solution to the problems of not just Germany, but as they could be adapted to the various countries of Europe. And, you know, just recently, there's been a book put out which points out that some of America's leading academic institutions and scholars were absolutely dumbfounded by what they considered the brilliance of Adolf Hitler and the solutions that he was offering for the problems of Germany.
He was brilliant, Michael. And I want to mention this to you because I just pulled the book out. And my favorite book about Adolf Hitler, and I haven't read hundreds, or I haven't read that all that many, but is The Young Hitler I Knew by his youthful friend August Kubitschek.
Yes, exactly.
I found that book more illuminating than anything I have ever read about him, and it's just amazing. But people who don't like Hitler and want to find fault with him can take what's in this book and say, well, this guy was a nut from the beginning.
Now, give me another example.
But he was brilliant, he had so much confidence to go his own way.
No, exactly. You know, there's a new book out now called Hitler's Private Library.
I have that book.
Yes, and that book, while it's presented to the public as, oh, this is an insight into the crazed mind of Adolf Hitler, But if you read the book, see that this guy we call Adolf Hitler, had an amazing private library.
Oh,
he
yes.
was widely read on so many topics.
He could have been a very, very good architect. He was a very good painter. He loved art. He was a genius.
Yeah, and so you see, these are the kind of things. These are precisely the kind of things that I've already. My research material is already there on like about 20 or 30 cassettes that I now need to transcribe and weave it all together. And I'm very confident that. Let me put it this way. I hate to be so boisterous about my own work, but I think that those who read this book that I am writing will find it to be one that will open their eyes in many respects. And those who read the book and refuse to accept what they've seen presented in these pages are simply foolish people who really have no desire to see the truth.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of
simple.
Those. There's a lot of those. Do you have a title, a working title, or what do you think it's going to be?
Well, I owe it to the late Leon DeGrelle.
Okay.
Called The Hitler Century.
Oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, DeGrelle, he had originally projected, when he was working with Willis Cardo, DeGrelle intended a 14-volume series of books about Hitler, covering various aspects of his career. And the entire set of volumes was going to be entitled The Hitler Century. And, you know, I tell you, what made me choose that, number one, was because I thought it would be a great, that title, that it would be a good tribute to DeGrelle because he never got to finish the work. But more importantly, over the past several years, I have seen these rumblings within the academic community. I use that term academic very loosely. These rumblings within the academic community about their great fear that Hitler somehow may be rehabilitated, and that in the 21st century, as we get further and further away from Adolf Hitler, people will forget how bad and how rotten and how evil and how perverted and how dangerous he really was. So my point is that I think in the 21st century, maybe long after we're gone, but I hope in our lifetimes, but that people are going to take a second look at the 20th century, the Jewish century, and see that, in fact, Adolf Hitler was right.
Yeah, so you're taking what has been called the Jewish century and saying it's the Hitler century.
Well, the 21st century, I think, will be the Hitler century when people...
Oh, the 21st. Oh, I gotcha. I thought you were talking about...
No. Hitler rose up against the Jewish century and got pounded down, not unexpectedly, when you consider...
Oh, wow. This is your...
Yeah, but in the 21st century, people will be able to look back and say, hey, wait a minute, what we were told by the Jewish-controlled newspapers and magazines and the broadcast media, it was all a lie. It was the very big lie that Adolf Hitler talked about. And that's what it's going to be. And I, as I say, the book wrote itself. Or I should say, it's so easy, I guess, when it really comes down to it. It's so easy when people put out so much nonsense and idiocy to knock it down.
Yes.
The cold hard facts. So,
but still, it'll be fun. It'll be great to read that. Michael, we've run out of time.
Oh.
We're going to have to close now. I'm so glad we got to find out about your book, and it's been a great pleasure. Time flew. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. Well, we look forward to more of your podcasts. I've listened to every one of them, and I intend to continue listening. So, thanks again, and listeners, I'm sure you enjoyed this program, and tune in next week for Eric Hunt.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.